We'd like to have the RAC members introduce themselves. First of all, we'd like to recognize the new members that are on the RAC. Go ahead, Ron, and introduce yourself. Do them first. Ron, go ahead and...
Ben.
Yeah. Go ahead and introduce yourself. Let's have the new ones do it first. Go ahead.
Yeah, Ben Lauder. A lot of you have probably seen me here before representing the Utah Bowmen's Association. I'm new to the RAC as an at-large representative.
Okay. Ken Strong as a sportsman's rep.
Okay. Alan?
Alan White. I live in Heber City. I'm agriculture representative.
Okay. Ron?
My name is Ron Camp. I'm a sportsman's representative. Spent a lot of time with multiple conservation groups.
Okay. Sarah, do you just want to go? We'll go around now.
Yeah.
There you go.
Sarah Flinders, Forest Service.
Chris Schmitz, non-consumptive.
Larry Fitzgerald, agriculture.
Chris Marble, public at large.
Carl Hurst, sportsman.
Okay.
Don't forget to recognize yourself.
Okay. And I'm Richard Hansen. I'm the chairman of the Central RAC. We'll excuse Dan Potts. He has, some family matters that he had to take care of. Won't be here tonight. And our central region director.
Do I get to introduce myself?
Yep, go
just
ahead.
Just John Fairchild. I don't vote. I just nudge him when he's off track.
Yeah, he's got to help me. Okay. This is a public forum allowing the public to express their ideas and opinions, and we encourage you to do that. We'd like to have you all encourage anyone that you know to be part of this. I know sometimes there's a lot of talk that says it doesn't make any difference, but it does make a difference. And I know several times where I know that my vote has been changed simply because of what the public has brought to the table. And so we encourage you to do that. We all have our own ideas, and I just encourage all of us to state those comments and our ideas in a respectful way and allow others to do the same thing. On the table as you entered in, there's some yellow cards that you need to fill out if you want to speak to a specific item so that we can give you that time to do that. You'll be given, if you represent a group, you'll be given a 10 to, the division will first make a presentation, and we'll be given the information on that. At the end of each presentation, I'll ask the RAC members if they have any questions regarding the presentation. I'll then ask the audience if they have any questions concerning what was presented. When you come to the mic, please state your name and the question. This is a time for questions and clarifications only and not a time for comments. We'll do that later. Once all of the members of the audience have asked their question, the period will be closed. Once the question period is closed, we will ask for public comment, and that is the time when you can make comments and give your ideas or proposals for any particular item. Please state your name, and if you're speaking for a group, the organization that you represent, and then you'll have three minutes for individual comments. If you're representing an organization, you'll have 5 minutes. After all a public comment has been received, I'll close the public comment period and allow the council to deliberate, make motions, and vote on the subject. So I ask that you just... be respectful in your comments and allow others to be the same. And I'll turn over the time now to John. Oh, first we've got to do this. We need to have the approval of the agenda and the minutes from last BRAC meeting. member of the REC.
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes from the last REC.
Have a second. Carl?
Second.
Carl Hurst? Okay. All in favor? Indicate. Okay, the vote was unanimous. Okay. Give you a little bit of an update on what happened at the last board meeting. Be fairly brief. They talked about some waterfall recommendations, which really involved the northern region mostly. There were some changes there on times and that sort of thing. They have formed a special committee to be able to try to compose some kind of something that will work for everybody as much as possible. They talked about the urban deer control and the program that was in place and what they'd like to do for this coming year. The vote on that was unanimous, and so that passed. The central region specific, they talked about the habitat management plan. That passed 3-1. There was a lot of discussion concerning the changes to the boundaries of the Oak Creek limited entry deer unit. And it was a really good discussion. There were a lot of land. There were several landowners there, and ultimately that passed. I think it was unanimously at the end when it finally all when the vote was taken. But there was a good discussion on that, so that is going to be changed for the next season, next year, 2016. And then they held elections. For the Wildlife Board for the chairman and vice chair. John Baer was elected as the chairman of the Wildlife Board, and Kirk Woodard was elected as the vice chair. That's it.
Okay, let me give you a quick update on activities within the central region, and I'll start off with aquatics. In October, we plan to kick off a planning effort to develop a fisheries management plan for Jordanelle. If any of you have fished it lately, you probably know why. Mill Creek Restoration Project will take place in September. This is phase three of a treatment to reestablish the native Bonneville cutthroat trout in the Mill Creek drainage. That involves a lot of partners. So if you see purple water, that's just detoxification of the rotenone. So that's always, we get people lined up wondering why we put Kool-Aid in the stream. But a new population, actually not a new one, but one that was encountered once again, a boreal toad found in a Lake Creek drainage in Wasatch County. So your sensitive species are on the rebound up there. And then there is a quite a nice video that that the Soil Conservation Districts have put together in Wasatch County on the Main Creek Restoration Project. And I don't know, Alan, if you were able to see that. It was kind of hosted by Terry Wood, former anchor. I can give you that link there. You'll probably get a kick out of it. You'll know all the people, I'm sure, that are the landowners up there. Third annual bow fishing tournament at Yuba State Park on August 1st. In wildlife, Wasatch West spring bear hunt, there was a harvest objective of 30 animals, and it was reached prior to the end of the season. Hopefully, those are animals that aren't needed to be taken by wildlife services. So we're trying to have sportsmen do the harvest and not the government trappers. Elk classification is coming to a close. We're on the Manti last week and classified over 800. Mountain's still green. It's a nice way to spend a couple days. West Desert Pronghorn classification will take place in early August. That's on the ground. Following the passage or the approval of the Urban Deer Control Administrative Rule by the Wildlife Board, cities are now going to be able to take advantage of some authority to manage deer within city limits, and we expect quite a few cities to be contacting us to participate in that. Statewide, the statewide elk committee meetings next get together is on August 11th, and that's probably the second to the last, if not the last, meeting that we'll hold with that group. That'll be the fifth, Amanda, I believe so. You've taken all the minutes, so you probably know better than anyone. Rocky Mountain Goat Surveys, August 6 and 7. In the habitat section, we've got quite a few habitat restoration projects going on. We'll have a 1,000-acre treatment, Spanish Fork Canyon, involving bull hog treatment in Sheep Creek and lop and scatter in Mill Creek. The Mill Creek one's on private land, the Martineau property. Dog Valley, there's a chaining project also on private land. Chaining and bull hog treatment in the Vernon area, and that's for sage-grouse habitat improvement. And for those that don't know, bull hog is just a big piece of equipment with that churns up trees from the top down. It's pretty impressive. But it's one tree removed at a time. It creates less surface disturbance, so there's less environmental impacts. A fuels reduction project on our Santaquin Wildlife Management Area in partnership with the Forest Service. You can imagine if a fire started south of Santaquin on the east side of the highway, all those new homes just on the east side there would be at risk. So Forest Service is involved in reducing fuel loads there. Provo River Delta Project, the Utah Reclamation Mitigation and Conservation Commission issued a record of decision on that, and that is currently out for public review. That would be a very significant project to benefit June sucker in Utah Lake and spawning habit or young fish habitat. Five upland game guzzlers will be installed on our Santaquin West Hills. We'll be helping the Utah Chucker and Wildlife Foundation put those in later this year. I imagine, Dennis, you're probably quite involved in that one. And last but not least, a vault toilet for Burston Ponds.
All right.
Conservation outreach. Three community fishing ponds were added to the program this year, Springville, Santaquin, and Deer Valley. Youth fishing clinics, sign-ups were up, and cities taught more classes. The final numbers aren't in yet, but our community fishing pond fishing clinic program is doing well. In our walk-in access, we've re-signed the Victory Ranch, that Upper Provo piece, for another 3 years, and we'll be partnering with several landowners to improve pheasant habitat in areas where we'll be releasing birds this fall. Dedicated hunter program, pretty busy lining up projects right now ahead of the archery hunt, so we encourage people not to put that off. And our central region has entered the 21st century. We have our own Facebook page, DW, Division of Wildlife Resources Central. It's not Central Region, it's just Central. So if you missed out on anything here, I got half my stuff from there. No, just kidding. Law enforcement, very important part. Guys represented in the back. Targeting Deer Creek with the quagga mussel issues there. It's suspected. We still have, I think there have been two sampling events We have not detected live villagers or anything that would indicate that we have living quagga mussel in Deer Creek, but since we detected the DNA, there's a three-year process where we have to go through and verify that it is not there for 3 years. Deer Creek State Park has greatly increased the number of seasonal employees that are at the marinas checking boats and doing decontaminations, quite a few at Deer Creek, and we have personnel at the port of entry those hauling boats up the canyon, up Daniels, are required to stop when that station is open. We had a law enforcement checkpoint at Strawberry that was very successful, reminding anglers about our slot limits, and I think they were able to give some special reminders to a few. And Ray Loken was promoted to sergeant of our North crew, so good for Ray. Any questions? I covered it all then. Good enough. Cheers.
Okay, let's move on to the first action item. Leslie McFarland, Mammals Coordinator, the Cougar Management Plan.
You can see I'm not tall, right?
It's
intimidating.
Push it back. I want you to be comfortable.
Okay, so there are a lot of different faces here than the ones I've seen before, so I'll try and cover some of the basics on the history with the Cougar Plan and things to give you a little bit of background. Okay. So first off, in 1999, our first Cougar Management Plan was implemented and put together. Prior to that, cougar permits were just sold over the counter. There was unlimited control on harvest. It was just a first-come, first-serve type management. In 1999, our first cougar management plan was implemented, and that plan lasted for 10 years. That plan had several different performance targets that were included in it that included age objectives, female objectives and that type of thing. In 2009, with the ending of that 10-year plan, some revisions and minor amendments were made to that plan between 2009 and 2011. The changes that were implemented during that time period were trying to take advantage of genetic information that we had on cougar populations. So we know in Utah that cougar populations use really broad and broad geographic areas. And so they don't really use what we define as a management unit. They use larger areas. And so that revision there was trying to combine management units to try and account for cougar biological structure, social structure, and that type of thing. The problem is that when we use hunting units and that type of thing, what we're really managing are people that are harvesting cougars. And it didn't really work. It created a lot of problems. We had over-harvest in some areas. We had under-harvest in some areas trying to implement the broad geographic area. It upset a lot of the public, houndsman's group. It actually upset internally a lot of our biologists who were trying to do management strategies. So in 2013, the Wildlife Board directed the division to simplify the plan and allocate permits back on a unit-by-unit basis and not in large geographic areas. In 2014, when we went to the board, which was this last July, we requested 1 year to form the Cougar Advisory Group and get input from all of our different constituents that use Cougar or are interested in Cougar management. And so that's what we did. A couple things with the previous plan, the 2009 plan, that our revision will address. One was the ecoregion or large-scale geographic implementation of hunting strategy. The previous plan also locked us into three-year recommendations. So when we came before you, we did it once every 3 years. And whatever we recommended, that's what we stuck with for a three-year period. And that's really, it didn't allow us to be responsive if we had depredation issues, if we had nuisance issues, and population issues with prey species. So we're going back to an annual recommendation process with cougars. Lastly, our cougar management plan didn't address prey population management. It didn't tie the two together. We had an internal policy that looked at predation, but we used to determine when we were going to put predator management into effect on a unit. With this revision of the plan, we're trying to take that and put it into the actual cougar management plan and evaluate prey populations on an annual basis with our cougar recommendations. And we're trying to get away from having predator management plans for each unit that dictate it. And we're trying to tie it so that prey populations actually dictate when you do it. So as you can see, there were over 20 members that participated in the Cougar Advisory Group, 20 voting members. There were several division employees. We had a BLM representative. We had members that participated in the DEER plan, the Farm Bureau. We had FNAS representatives. We had representatives from Guides and Outfitters. So we tried to be very broad. We also had two representatives from the non-consumptive community that that helped with the plan. Mike King was our Wildlife Board member representative. As you can guess, the meetings were quite emotional at times because everybody has a very strong feeling about predator prey. They love their deer, they love their bighorn sheep, and we also have people that really love their cougars. And so it did get emotional at times. We had five meetings from December 2014 to April 2015, and overall we spent over 50 hours discussing the management plan. And at this point, I'd really like to thank the members of the Cougar Advisory Group for all of their time and commitment. Many of them were not paid representatives from sportsmen's groups. They took time off of work to come and help us put this together. It's also important to know that the Cougar Advisory Group was limited to that of advising the division on issues and concerns regarding cougar resource, its use, and impacts on other land uses. So they were assisting us in updating the plan, and we took their recommendations. Once that was done, the plan was reviewed internally by our biologists to make sure that it was something that we could all live with. So the plan goal overall that the group came up with was to maintain a healthy cougar population within their current distribution while considering human safety, economic concerns, other wildlife species, and maintaining hunting traditions. The definition that we use to define a healthy cougar population is one that maintains a reasonable proportion of older age animals, breeding females, healthy individuals, balanced with its natural prey and genetic variability. So our first population management objective is to maintain cougar populations within their current statewide distribution in a manner that recognizes the large geographic and temporal scales that cougars use populations. So although we recommend permits on a hunting unit basis, our biologists are looking at overall recommendations and overall regional impacts on cougar populations. Even though that's not how we recommend it, we're considering those things. We want to stress the importance of social structure for long-term viability. So this is, it's important that you protect your females, which help increase your population. Sub-adult males are your primary dispersers, and they'll always usually disperse. Females usually go only if you have high densities or poor habitat. In general, males travel more than females and have larger territories and won't breed until they establish home ranges. So with our age objectives that we put into the plan, we're trying to consider this part of the social structure of cougars. We want to direct hunter pressure on a management unit or subunit basis, so all of our recommendations are going forward will be unit by unit. And we want to manage cougar abundance with respect to their ungulate prey. And this is a new addition to the plan that was not in there before, and I'm actually really excited that we've put this in the plan because I think it will help solve some of the issues that we've had with cougar hunters and houndsmen feeling like we never take units out of predator management. We just leave them in, and once they go in, they stay in. But we also want to make sure that the deer groups, the sheep groups, know that we are paying attention to what the prey populations are doing, and we will try and do some things to help prey populations if possible. So just a little bit of background on our cougar harvest strategies. Hunting in Utah is controlled by three different strategies. Either limited entry, which is one where you have to put in for a drawing, you draw a permit for that unit, and you're the only one that can go on that unit if you have a limited entry permit. The season there stays open until the end date. There's no quota or anything on it. A split is one where it starts as limited entry, so you put in, you draw a permit for that unit, and then we hit a transition date, and your split permit turns into a harvest objective permit, which you can use on any harvest objective unit, or people with harvest objective permits can come into that area. They can hunt in a split unit until the quota, which is the number of permits that were issued, is met or the season date closes. Harvest objective is our basic quota system, and so we establish the number of cougars that we want removed from an area. The unit stays open until the number of cougars reach that quota or the season date closes. Hunters that hunt in a harvest objective or split season during the harvest objective are required to call in every day to make sure that the quota hasn't been met and that the season hasn't been closed. So within the cougar plan, there are two different types of strategies. We have cougar management and we have predator management. Cougar management is when is the primary management tool for cougars. It's when your prey population is doing well and you have no depredation, livestock, or nuisance issues in the area. Predator management is when you've got issues with prey populations, bighorn sheep, or we've got nuisance issues or livestock issues that we need to address. And I'll go through each of the targets that we established for these. So straight cougar management. So we have no issues with deer populations in the area. We have no issues with bighorn sheep. What we're trying to manage for is that the proportion of all of the females in our harvest is less than 40%, and that's averaged over 3 years. So we take all of the data in harvest for the previous 3 years and make sure that we're not harvesting over 40%. Most cougar populations can sustain harvest of up to 20 to 30%. When you start getting up into the 40% range, you start having effects on fecundity, reproduction, your social structure, and so most states try and remain below 40%. This is a change from the previous plan. The previous plan looked at only adult females in the harvest. This considers all females, whether they're reproducing or not. And then the secondary target, so first you look at the harvest, and as long as you're less than 40%, then the second thing that you look at are the ages of the cougars that you've harvested. We want to have an age structure where 15 to 20% of the harvest consists of animals that are 5 years or older. If it's higher than that, that tells you that you've got an older, more mature population. If it's less than that, then it tells you that you don't have the older age animals and you probably need to reduce your permits and your harvest. So like I said, I just kind of explained the strategies. So first you'll take and you look at the proportion of your females. If it's less than 40%, then like I said, you look at the number of animals that are over 5 years of age. If it's greater than 20%, then you can increase permits. If your age is between 15 to 20%, you may maintain, or you can't, the biologist at their discretion could decrease or increase if they've got a special issue, such as livestock depredation that they're trying to address. If the age structure is less than 15%, like I said, you've got too many young animals in your harvest and not enough older animals, so you have to decrease your harvest. If the proportion for cougar management is over 40%, there's no option to look at age or anything else. It's an automatic decrease for your unit. The caveat that we've seen as we tried to implement this year with our recommendations is that if you have a few units with very small sample sizes, an animal here or there can skew the whole ratio. So we're asking for our biologists in those cases to make their best knowledgeable call on their units and what their unit needs. And after that, they select the strategy, either limited entry, split, or harvest objective that they want for that unit. So for predator management, there are some triggers that you have to meet in order to qualify for predator management. So what we did, I worked with our big game coordinator, Justin Shannon, and we looked at lots of our deer herd unit survival data and our objectives, our population objectives. If a deer population in the previous year is less than 65% of the objective, then it can qualify for predator management. We have 6 units this year, deer units, that qualify for predator management under this plan. If your deer population is less than 90% of the unit objective and either condition below is met, so your adult deer survival for 2 of the previous 3 years is less than 84% and your population is declining, or your adult deer survival is less than 80% in the previous year and it also shows a declining trend, then it would qualify for predator management. Right now, all of our deer units show an increasing trend. So all of our deer units that are not less than 65% of unit objective do not qualify for predator management for mule deer this year. We also have some triggers for bighorn sheep, and almost all of our bighorn sheep units fall within this target. So most of our predator management this upcoming year will be focused on bighorn sheep areas. If the population is less than 90% of the unit objective, or the population has less than 125 animals. We also have a section in there that addresses transplants, and we try to target and do some predator control if we're going to be releasing susceptible animals into an area or we have released susceptible animals into an area. So like deer transplants, bighorn sheep transplants, and so we can be a little more aggressive in those areas to try and give the reintroduction a chance to take place. After a period of about 3 years, then we'd probably back off. But we're going to monitor that reintroduction to see what happens with it before we back off. So with predator management, that was all the primary target that we want to hit when we're trying to reduce or control a cougar population is we want to see the proportion of females in our harvest to be greater than 40% because we're trying to reduce or lower that population and have an impact. So that's the only target that we have for predator management. If your so as you look at your data and it's under predator management, if the proportion of females is less than 40%, we can make the recommendation to increase the permits or quota up to double, but we can't go more than double of the previous year. If the proportion of females is greater than 40%, then we'll just maintain the quota or the permit level at the current level. And this, they can also use limited entry, harvest objective, or split. We have a couple areas in the state that are defined within our plan as bighorn sheep management areas. In these areas, bighorn sheep are the primary prey base for cougars. There are relatively no deer in these areas, so the only thing they have to eat are the only real ungulate that they have to eat are bighorn sheep. These units are all low elevation, snow-free habitat, and little, if any, cougars are ever harvested on these units. These units remain open year-round, and there's no limit on harvest. These are the San Rafael, the Kaparowitz, and the Buck Cliffs rattlesnake. There was one rule change recommendation through the plan that and it'll be in the next presentation, but they wanted to recommend a couple options or tools for us to increase our ability to do predator management for bighorn sheep. One of those was to allow people to possess two cougar permits on those unlimited quota bighorn sheep management areas. To continue to use DWR employees to help remove cougars in those situations, to continue to contract with Wildlife Services, and then another addition was to allow the division the ability to contract or authorize someone outside the agency to help with removal of depredating animals. And like I said, one of the biggest additions to this plan is the evaluation of deer population response annually, as well as bighorn sheep, based on three-year averages to help to determine the need to continue or discontinue predation management direction. There were some other parts of the plan that we really made no changes to, but I'll mention them here just so that you know that they are part of the plan, and that's an outreach and education section with objectives to increase awareness and appreciation for the role of cougars in Utah's ecosystems, education and awareness about cougar safety, especially along the urban front, and just trying to provide educational opportunities on the relationship between cougars and prey populations. One of the components is to educate hunters on how to tell the age and sex of cougars to increase harvest selectivity. We do have an online course that's a voluntary course that we've tried to use that to educate people. And then just increasing our educational opportunities with sportsmen and other user groups prior to RAC and board meetings and the reasons why we're recommending what we're recommending. There's a section in there that deals with chronic livestock depredation. That section is working really well, so there were no changes or amendments to this section. Chronic livestock depredation primarily occurs on private lands, although there are some public areas that qualify for this. If an agricultural producer has depredation for 3 consecutive years or 4 out of 5 years, has a history of depredating, cougars depredating on sheep or cattle, they can come to us and we can issue them a permit to go and remove the animal. They can do it prior to turning sheep out in an area if they've had problems in that area before. We did add some information to our Cougar Research Center section. One of the things that we really know that we need to do is increase our base understanding on cougar populations in Utah. One of the projects that we're looking at implementing in the future is similar to that we do with our deer survival, and that's maybe radio collaring cougars in different parts of the state and getting some survival estimates that will help us model populations better and get at some of these questions to help us make better recommendations in the future. So in summary, we're recommending that this be a 10-year plan with an internal review by the division at 5 years. I believe that it provides us guidance and direction for managing our cougar populations, and overall I believe it's a simplified version of a plan. Again, we'll be recommending permits, recommendations on an annual basis, and they will go back to unit by unit. An important component of this plan is that prey populations are considered, and all of our cougar recommendations in the next presentation were made in accordance with this plan. And again, I really want to thank the members of the Cougar Advisory Group for their time and dedication and efforts drafting the plan.
Thank you, Leslie. That was well done. Any questions or clarifications from the RAC for Leslie? Anybody got anything? Chris?
Thanks for that, Leslie. It looks like you've been busy this year. You've got a lot of stuff going on.
Took a bit of time.
I just had a couple of questions. What criteria do you use to determine the hunt strategy on these units?
A lot of it, the hunt strategy is based on the biologist's personal knowledge of the unit. Some of it depends on what they want to do. In the past, in the previous plan, harvest objective was only allowed on units that were under predator management. With this version of the plan, we changed that because there are some units that we aren't getting the harvest that we need to through limited entry, and maybe a year or two a harvest objective would help us achieve that, and then we could go back to limited entry. So, for example, there are some units in northern Utah that are primarily private land, and harvest objective really wouldn't work there because what happens is you get increased trespass calls for people trying to get in. So it depends on the needs of the unit, and we rely on the biologist to try and pick the best strategy that they feel will work.
So it's a mix of social and biological needs.
Yes.
What is the purpose of a split strategy?
So the split strategy, what it does is it tries to give people in that unit a limited entry hunting opportunity, and if it fills up under the limited entry thing, it never transitions to split. But if it transitions to split, it gives other people more opportunity to go into that area where otherwise they couldn't go there.
So from a social aspect, if it's a split unit, somebody that draws a limited entry tag, do they really have a limited entry experience on those units?
They do at first because it's only a limited number of hunters.
Sure, but the harvest from previous years would be...
It depends on the population itself. Some of them do have better toms. Some of them do have less pressure. It just depends on the unit itself and the accessibility to the unit.
Okay. Thanks for that, Leslie. I just had one other question. It sounds like, you know, the committee put a lot of thought into the female portion of the harvest, etc., and then tying that to the ungulate species, which is good, especially deer. I'm wondering why the fawn counts weren't considered. I mean, it seems like that would trickle down, but it would take a couple years before it hit the other metrics, whereas if you considered fawn classifications, you could maybe react sooner.
So fawn counts are part of the survival. And so they're accounted for in your 84%, your 80%.
Okay, I thought that was only adult deer.
Well, so this is what it. So this is what we're looking at. These are the actual tables.
Mm-hmm.
And is the survival, Tom, is that only adult deer? I thought it accounted for fawn doe ratios. So.
Okay.
So it is considered in there.
It's total survival then, yeah. Not adult. I'm sorry, I thought the slide said adult survival, so that's
it
why.
It might say adult. I might go back and fix that. Hey.
All right, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Ken? On the Pavant, we're taking the time to transplant deer on the Pavant, and yet you lowered the cougar permits. What was the reasoning on that?
Well, we can get into that when we do recommendations, but if you, are you talking Pavant or Mount Dutton?
Pavant.
So the recommendations were given to me by the regions, and I went with what the regions requested. I can tell you.
Why don't we do that?
Yeah, that'd be good. We can get into each individual unit later.
Okay. Any more questions? Christine?
I'm just curious. How do you evaluate the effectiveness of the education piece of this?
Good question. you know, there were some objectives in the previous plan that said increase knowledge by 80%, but there's no way to do that, so I took that out. The only thing that we can do is try and work with our outreach section. We try and do media things. When we release cougars that are in urban areas, we try and use that as an educational opportunity, because I'll tell you, the cougar that the central region released a couple months ago created nationwide attention for Utah. And so we try and use all of those types of things, but there's not really an effective way to measure how many people you reach, and I don't know how to evaluate our effectiveness.
Leslie, I pulled this up, and just to clarify it, in the draft that I've got here, it does say adult deer survival. For whatever it's worth, it doesn't account for fawn survival.
That would be a more consistent measure. Fawns can go up and down. I mean, bad winter, you could lose them all.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at, right? Yeah, there is, if you have a bad winter, you're going to wait 2 or 3 years till your adult survival drops.
Yeah, so. So, yeah, that, and I'm trying to remember back to all of our discussion, and that was our discussion, is cougars will target the adults more.
Sure.
So that is why. But that, when you guys do that, it's adult survival, right? Okay. It's your data, so.
Okay. I just wanted to know why, so thank you. So you wouldn't have a concern if you have a low fawn-producing year, bad winter, whatever, what have you, that you don't need to adjust for cougar numbers? Uh-huh. Well, sure, and I'm not suggesting that the cougars would be the reason for the low fawn numbers, but rather they could be an inhibiting factor in increasing
I'll just give you an example on how we use the data. Mm-hmm. So these are the numbers that were given to me by our big game section on mule deer abundance, the mule deer percent of objective, our adult doe survival, and it is adult doe survival. It doesn't include fawns. I just have to read my own table. So what we do, so I'll use a unit here. So let's look at Oker Stansberry. Okay. So we'll look at Oker Stansberry. So the population objective for deer is 11,600. In 2014, it was 11,200. So the percent of objective is 97%. So it's greater than 90%, so it doesn't qualify for predator control because it's not less than 90%. But if you go to Central Mountains Nebo, it's at 62%. And so it qualifies because it's less than 65. And that's one of the five units this year that would qualify for predator management for cougars. Then if you go over and you look, so let's find one that's less than 90% but greater than 65. So if you look at Central Mountains Manti, then the next step in this process would be, okay, it's less than 90% of its objective. It's at 66%. It's too high to qualify for less than 65. But then you have to look at adult doe survival for the previous 3 years. Is it less than 84%? Yeah, it is for all 3 years. Is it less than 80% the previous year? It's at 82. So it would qualify for predator management, except for there's the little caveat in there that it has to be a decreasing population. And right now, all of our deer populations through all of our model data show that we're increasing. So it kicks it out of predator management. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I was just wondering if, and I think you've answered it, but just if the long survival is a tying those two species
because of
that prey predator balance.
Uh-huh. Maybe you can help me. I believe you have to, you're required, it's not a voluntary test to get a harvest objective bear tag. And I think you mentioned that it would be a voluntary test with cougars.
Cougars, it's only a voluntary thing. And the reason being is that bear harvest objective is just newly implemented. We've only been doing it for a couple of years. There were concerns about female bears in the harvest. And so we're doing so few harvest objective permits on bears that we made it a requirement.
Would there be a benefit? You don't see any benefit of making it required with the cougars?
At this point, probably not. Most people either harvest a cougar using hounds. I don't know. Haven't gotten into that part of it quite yet. I don't have an opinion, I guess.
Any other questions?
All I know is that when I made it mandatory for bear hunters, I got a lot of hate mail. So, making me do something else for another permit. Sorry.
Okay. Any other questions? I have one question, though. I know there's some fawn survival studies going on mm-hmm. right now. And, in fact, up on the Monroe Mountain, I passed those division kids that are camped up there all the time, and I'm sure they're chasing the, you know, those implants and that sort of thing. When will that data be available, do you know?
I believe we're in the final year of that, and so they should have a report within the next year.
Okay, that'll be interesting. Okay, no other questions from Iraq. Any questions or clarifications from the public? Okay, if not, any comments? I have one card. Aaron Johnson, would you like to come? And
thank you. You've heard Leslie a couple of times thank the members of the Cougar Advisory Committee, and I think it's really important to realize how much time Leslie put into it. She mentioned that these guys probably put in 50 hours. She probably put in over 1,000. And so, Leslie, we really appreciate what you've done. I'm Aaron Johnson with Utah Houndsman Association, and the Utah Houndsman Association supports the Cougar Management Plan as it's written, and we ask you to vote it and accept it as it is.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
Quick question.
Sure.
Leslie, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but...
Oh, I'm here.
I just had a quick question. There's a...
You state your name.
Jason Walker. I'm just representing myself.
Okay. Thank you.
There's a you talked a lot about the females and the 40%. But I do see a couple units here that aren't predator management plans, but the take on females is above that mark, and the permits are staying the same. Or
We can go into that when we do the unit by unit recommendations. But if they're in the northern region, it's because they were very small sample sizes.
Yeah, these are mostly down south, but
some of that, like there's a Mount Dutton one on there that has a 60%, and we're going to make an amendment here in just a minute on our recommended changes. But the reason for that is because of big game transplants.
Okay. All right.
Any other comments? Okay. Bring it back to the rack for your deliberation. Any motions?
I'll make a motion to accept the cougar management plan as presented.
Okay. Second? Carl? Okay, we have a motion and a second to accept the cougar management plan as presented. All in favor? Okay, appears unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was worried about that one.
Okay, let's move in. Leslie will present the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations. Ooh. Or excuse me.
Cougar.
The cougar. Recommendations and rule amendments for next year.
Okay, so like I mentioned earlier, cougar harvest in Utah has been managed under limited entry hunting since 1999. A dramatic increase in the number of permits and harvest occurred in the mid-90s, and that was actually a west-wide focus on cougar hunting. It occurred in most of the western states. In 1997, our agency added additional harvest pressure by switching some units to harvest objective or quota system. And a record number of permits were sold that year. We sold 1,496. Since 2000, we have averaged 327 limited entry permits, and we've had an average quota of 254. This past season for 2015, the one that's currently just ended, we offered 460 permits and quotas. 253 of those were limited entry or split, and 207 were quota. Total sport harvest was 330 animals with a 45% success rate on limited entry units and a 68% success rate for harvest objective. Total harvest, including wildlife services, nuisance take, depredation, and roadkill or other unknown mortality, was 345 animals. Compared with 2014 season, which was 376. The important thing for us to track management-wise for cougars is the proportion of females that occur in our harvest. So if you look at this graph here, the light peach line on the top is total sport harvest. The darker brown line are total males in the harvest, and then the rust-colored line on the bottom is our proportion of females in the harvest. When your females and your male lines start to converge, you're taking too many females, and you're actually probably affecting populations. And so what we want to see is kind of what we have here, with the two lines being separate and your female harvest not equaling your male harvest. And so that's what we're looking for. So again, the proportion of females to males in our sport harvest, this is kind of a historical look, and you can go back to the 90s and see that our proportion of females actually got up to 50% in some periods between 1997 to 2004. The females are the dark gray color, and the males in the harvest are the lighter gray. Our current threshold that we've established for female harvest is to maintain females in the harvest less than 40%. And you can see that since about 2008, we've maintained that pretty well, even with the previous plan. Right now, we're about 30. For the past 3 years, we're at 35% adult females in the harvest. Total females in the harvest. In the past, we looked at percent adult females, and we wanted to keep that between 22 to 25%. These numbers here include our harvest objective and our predator management unit. So even with heavy harvest on our predator management statewide, we're not going above 40%. And most cougar populations, like I mentioned earlier, can sustain rates of about 20 to 30%. We monitor our populations through mandatory reporting of all of our hunter-harvested cougars, any cougars that we find killed on the highways or in accidents, or those taken as a result of livestock depredation or nuisance. We record the location of kill, the sex, and the age. And we take a premolar tooth for all of our age estimations. And so the effect that hunting has on a cougar population depends on the level of harvest and the sex and age of the cougars that are removed. And like I said earlier, with our plan, we want to protect our breeding females. Females can breed as early as 16 to 21 months, but most research indicates that they don't breed till about 26 to 30 months. Males reach breeding maturity at 24 to 30 months and gain resident status. They'll usually establish a territory by the age of 3. And so that's kind of why we try and why we felt it was important to put an age structure objective into our plan. In the past couple years, in 2013, 33% of the animals were greater than 5 years and older. This past year, about 25% of the animals statewide were greater than 5 years. So our livestock depredation, we pay on livestock losses to cougar damage and also bear, wolves, and eagles. Since 2001, our agency has paid a total of $907,000 for livestock depredation to animals that were confirmed killed by cougars. This past year, we paid $148,000, of which $44,749 was for confirmed loss to cougars, with 34 claims and 241 confirmed losses. You can see here that the number of incidents since 2001 has decreased, and we're actually at a level where it's maintaining a little bit. We only had 18 cougars taken last year, and we're still in the middle of our livestock depredation now, so I can't tell you what we'll end up with there. I'll go through recommendations for each region, and when I get to Central, Tom's going to come up and give you their presentation. But just a key to the recommendations here for each region. So the far left column is the unit. If it's under predator management, then it's the yellow column. And the species that it's under predator management for this recommendation cycle are listed. So either deer or bighorn sheep. And then the permit quota is, or the number of permits or quota that was offered last year, then the percent females, the percent greater than 5 years old, and then what we're recommending. If it's green, it represents an increase in permits or quota. If it's orange, it represents a decrease. The far right column is the strategy that the region's recommending, and if it's white, it's a change in strategy from the previous year. So here, Box Elder, Pilot Mountain, I'll just go through these briefly. They're recommending an increase in permits there for deer and bighorn sheep and a change in strategy from split to harvest objective. The cache, they're recommending an increase by 5. East Canyon, now they're recommending an increase of 2 to go to 6. East Canyon Davis Face is an area that's right above the urban interface, and they try and maintain a lot of cougar harvest there so that they don't end up with problems in town. So that one's under predator management for a nuisance purpose. That one, they're just recommending it stay at 5. The Morgan South Ridge is one of those units that, Jason, that like you were asking about. It's a landlocked private land area. The landowners largely control what's harvested in those areas, and they push people to take a lot of females. We don't believe we're getting the male. The region doesn't feel that they're getting the male harvest out of there that they really need, and it's only 6 permits. And so that's one of the ones that they're asking for an increase on, even though the female harvest is higher. And that's just one of those that is small sample, small number. It's hard to figure out. And then the Ogden unit, it's a decrease in permits by one because the percent females at 44%. Northeastern region, and this is the one that I think will cause a little bit of controversy, the Bootcliffs Bitter Creek unit. That unit is consistently at less than 65% of objective for the mule deer. Right now it's at 56%. It's a unit that the region's tried and tried and tried several different things to try and increase production on that unit. Last year the quota was at 20 and the unit closed down pretty quickly. The percent female is at only 28% and the age is at 30%, and our objective is 15 to 20. So you can see that they're harvesting relatively few females, and a lot of these are older age animals. So the region wanted to increase by 18. The other units within the region, they pretty much stayed the same except for Wasatch Mountain's Current Creek. There were only 7% females in the harvest, with 46% of those being over 5. And so they requested an increase of 2. That's also a unit that has a small sample size, so we're relying on the biologists and their knowledge of that unit. Thomas.
Keep track of that. We'll make it short. I'll make it short and simple. The Central Mountains NEBO is going to stay the same under the limited entry strategy.
Your strategies went from split to limited entry.
Oh, the light colored. We did make that change. Okay, so yeah, we went to a limited entry strategy on that one from the harvest objective. Or what was it before?
It was split.
Split. Central Mountains NEBO West Face. Stay the same with 10 permits. Again, we changed the strategy to limited entry. The Central Mountains Northwest Manti, was a reduction of 1 permit and a change in the strategy to limited entry. The Central Mountains Southwest Manti, that's a reduction of 1 permit and going to limited entry also. Stansbury, Oker Stansbury's, we did increase that one by 3 permits. As you can see, the female harvest is fairly low. It's not even close to the 40%, and a relatively high percentage of the males are above the 5-year age class. So that was a 50% increase in the number of permits. The Wasatch Mountains Cascade stays the same. and that stayed at a harvest objective. And the Wasatch Mountain Timpanogos stays the same, goes to harvest objective, or stays at harvest objective. The Wasatch Mountains West stays the same and stays at limited entry. The West Desert Mountain Ranges stayed the same, but that switched to a harvest objective, trying to get some harvest out there. It's just hard to get people out on the deep creeks to, even though there's a lot of cats out there for some reason, you look at that mountain and I think it scares some people. It's also pretty hard to get around being it's all wilderness. And so that has an impact on the ability to hunt. And the Tinnick Vernon stays the same. And again, that's one of those areas of low harvest. We really don't seem to get very much harvest out there at all, at least not in the last 3 years. So trying to generate some interest and still maintain a limited entry portion of that. So it's not a race, being that it's close to the Wasatch Front. And that's our Central Region recommendations.
Thanks, Tom. Southern Region recommendations. The beaver, it's a decrease by 1 because of the percent females in the harvest. The Fillmore Oak Creek stays the same. I'll just go over the changes from the previous year. The Fillmore Pavant is recommended to have a decrease of 1 because it's, and there's some things here we can, the Fillmore Pavant is a decrease. I'm not sure why the region recommended that where it's at 39, but I think they felt they needed to. The Kaparowitz again is a sheep unit with unlimited harvest. The Monroe is an increase in 1. It had a low percent female and low number of animals over 5. The Mount Dutton, this is an amended recommendation from the Southern Region, so this wasn't presented to the Northern Region RAC last night. They're because they've had some bighorn sheep or mountain goat and deer transplants that occurred there recently. They're requesting to keep that unit at 14 permits, and they're, even though the percent female is really high, to try and help these transplants succeed. The Ponsagant is an increase of 2. Pine Valley, none of the others change except for Plateau Fish Lake. That's also an increase of 2. And Plateau or Southwest Desert is an increase of 1. And they're recommending all of the same strategies as the previous year. Southeastern Region made really no recommendation changes from the previous year to any of their units. They stayed status quo. There is one, so the one change that we're requesting to make from the advice of the Cougar Advisory Group is to allow people the ability to harvest and possess 2 cougars if you hunt on a unlimited quota unit. So the first thing that you'd have to do, this is a recommended rule change, is that you have to have an objective harvest objective permit first for any other harvest objective unit, or a valid split permit. After the transition date, you can go into the unlimited quota unit and you can purchase a cougar control permit and have 2 cougar permits and hunt on those unlimited quota permits. The control permit is valid only in the unlimited quota units, and it would not be valid on any other unit in the state. The harvest objective and split would be valid on any of the harvest objective units or the split units. And in second here, I'm going to mention a boundary change to the Buck Cliffs Rattlesnake that will include a portion of the 9 Mile South and the Kaparowitz and the San Rafael. So those are the unlimited quota units. So just to kind of give you a comparison of permit numbers this year, 2015, we offered 253 limited entry and split permits. This year, we're recommending 246. Harvest objective quota totals, last year we recommended 207. This year we're recommending 249. There is one boundary change request out of the southeastern region, so this affects the 9 mile unit. They're taking and splitting the 9 mile unit into two portions, the 9 mile north and then the 9 mile south. On the 9 mile south portion, it pretty much mirrors the Book Cliffs rattlesnake unit. It's just across the river. There are little to no deer in this unit, and so they're asking to put that portion of the 9 mile into the Book Cliffs rattlesnake unit and make it an unlimited quota unit. The Ochre Stansberry, we have one boundary change on the request from this region, and this is just to make the boundaries consistent with the mule deer boundary changes that occurred recently, this last year. So it's just to keep things consistent. The season dates that we're recommending for cougar limited entry, November 11th through May 31st. Split, the limited entry portion would go November 11th through February 26th. The transition to harvest objective would occur on March 3rd through May 31st. Harvest objective season is a year-round season. It goes November 11th to November 6th. That stops about 5 days short of the next season. The unlimited quota unit is open year-round. It goes November 11th to November 10th. And the pursuit season is November 11th through May 31st. So in summary, the recommendations that we're making are in accordance with the Cougar Management Plan that was just passed. All females are considered in our harvest versus adult females as we did previously. We've added the age performance target as an extra measure on population status. And again, we'll do our recommendations annually on a unit-by-unit basis, and this does incorporate our pre-population performance into our cougar populations. And again, this will allow us evaluation of predator management on an annual basis. It's not resulting in a really significant increase or decrease in any of our units or our recommendations overall.
Hey, thank you, Leslie. Any questions from the RAC? Larry.
Sir Tom, Central.
Make him work.
Hopefully, I can answer. Concerning the burn,
okay.
You said you stated there wasn't much interest in the harvest in the burn.
Well, you know, if you look at the data, we haven't harvested anything the last 3 years. With four permits each year. No, not with the data we have here. We used to have the Vernon as a limited entry just because it was so close to the Wasatch. My thought was that it was always going to be a race. Everybody, it'll fill up right away within the first week or two, and it'll be over. And that generally doesn't keep us, if we had any depredation issues or anything else going on, we had kind of nowhere to go but with the government trapper. If we stretched it out with limited entry where guys are out, we could always call a limited entry hunter out and take care of a problem if we ever had it. So, but we haven't had the harvest in the last few years. So trying to generate a few more people out there now and with the harvest objective, and hopefully we'll get some harvest.
It is going into the harvest objective?
Yes.
Split.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Harvest objective.
As well,
it's a split on the Vernon. Well, let's see. Yeah.
I think it was split.
It's a split on the Vernon, and the Tinnick is harvest objective. So the Tinnick was another one that, I mean, we've harvested five over the last 3 years. But let's see. No, it was five on the Vernon and zero on the it was five. On the Vernon Tinnick, they're combined. Over the last 5 years, you're right. It's but that five over the last, we have four permits a year. They're going years without harvesting a cat. Yeah, and yeah, it doesn't appear like they're really catching the cats out there, and that's a surprise to me too. There was a time, yeah, we didn't have much snow there, but there was a time where the Vernon was separated from the Tinnick, and we since put those two together again. It's four for both. Yeah, it's the Vernon side of 36 and the Tinnick side 36 put together. So it's a pretty good size unit, and you would see four tags, you would think you would fill that up, but it doesn't seem to be happening. So try to get more people out there. We did the same thing out in the deep creeks.
Well, if you change it from limited entry to
it might, yeah. And the deep creeks, we've had a harvest objective, and I've had as many as eight tags out there, and we've never come close to eight harvested in a year, except once when they killed them off the Cedar Mountain Range. They didn't kill them on the deep creeks. So trying to generate some people to go out west and hope that they'll start taking some cats. There's a lot of cats on the deeps, but it seems to scare people. It's terrain and it's accessibility. Well, if you can make it snow and kind of make it so they can get into the wilderness a little easier, it might help. But it's one of those places that it's just hard, I'm sure. Sure, Mr. Steele knows.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay.
Any other questions? Kim?
I got a question, Leslie.
How fast, you're raising on the book cliffs from 20 to 38. How fast did you say they filled up last year?
Okay, so on the book cliffs for this last year, it closed down January 22nd. In 2013, it closed down February 8th. And in 2012, it closed... I don't have 2012. So both years it filled up by February 8th and February 2nd.
So they fill a quota pretty fast.
Yes.
We go over that recommendation again. That's,
I mean, that's half of the increase in harvest objective on that unit alone. So can you go over why that is again and the deer and all that?
So let me pull up the deer data just so that you can see. So the book cliffs, right now, this is the deer. The deer objective is set at 15,000. This past year, their estimate is 8,600. The percent of objective for the past 4 years has been between 41% and 57%. And so one of the triggers is anything less than 65% qualifies for predator management. The adult doe survival on that unit is less than 90%. For two of the 3 years, it's not less than 84. So overall, it doesn't qualify there. But the whole percent of objective, it's not meeting the population objective that they've got set for the unit.
Any other questions? Chris?
It looks like the houndsman had some concerns about missing data. I take it you have the data for the book lifts, the harvest data?
What do they think is missing?
Well, the letter here says 2014 and 2015. I guess there'd be no data for 2015, but... They were concerned that there wasn't data available.
So this does include 2015 data.
Well, I guess it would because, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
When we first ran this through, when we did our first meeting with them, probably the first part of July, mm-hmm. I didn't have all of the age data in here, and it changed very little. So recommendations pretty much stand the same as when I met with all of the groups at the 1st of July.
Okay. And then the only other question I had was, you know, I asked you earlier about the hunt strategies. Is there a reason why the Monroe was not chosen to be a limited entry unit? I think it's what a harvest objective.
It has had some studies that we did have research. Projects that have been going on.
Is that due to the deer studies going on down there?
Yes.
And the relocations from?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? I'd like to ask you something. Why did you put the Nebo and Nebo West Face into limited entry? What was the point of that?
Just to give opportunities for quality hunt for the cougar hunters.
Okay, has the number of animals taken ever met the harvest objective on that those units ever? I'm going to mention that to her. John had a good point. He just says that maybe we ought to have a column on there and to show whether or not any particular unit, what their harvest objective is and whether if it ever has reached that harvest objective in that year.
Just harvest success.
Success, yeah.
They yelled at me for having too busy of a table already. So.
But knowing how many animals were taken based on the permit numbers would maybe justify or give some rationale for the last column of what the strategy was.
Honestly, I've let the regions pick the rationale for the strategy that they need. Primarily up until this year, harvest objective has been used specifically for predator management. This will be the first time that we've allowed them to use it for just regular cougar management. So up until then, it was because it was under predator management for deer, more than likely. Or bighorn sheep.
Do we have any data to see whether or not, if it's in limited entry versus a split, that the harvest success is less or more?
So for limited entry and split, the harvest success was 40... It was 40-something percent. For harvest objective, it was 68%.
Okay. But what about just limited entry versus a split? Does that even...
We roll it all into one and count it for the unit, the harvest success for the unit, and count it as a limited entry because it's really difficult to go back, and I'm sure that I could get our biometrician to do it, but it's easier to roll it into one, and so that's the way it's given to me.
Okay. It'll be interesting if the plan passes down the road a couple of years, whether moving units to a limited entry increases or decreases the actual harvest.
So split does increase harvest. It does, because you get increased pressure, but I can't tell you what part of the success in that limited entry split was because it transitioned to split or because it was limited entry. I'd have to go back and have them pull all of the harvest by date in order to get a difference in success.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or clarifications from the audience? Oh, Ben, one more from the rack.
I just want to make sure I'm following this. So the Central Mountains Nebo and Nebo West Face are being recommended as limited entry, and prior they were harvest objective?
They were split.
They were split. Okay.
Any other? Okay. Any questions or comment or clarifications from the public? Okay.
You guys are being easy.
Okay, we have one comment card. Aaron Johnson, did you like to step up?
Thank you. I'm Aaron Johnson with the Utah Houndsman Association. I passed out a letter that we prepared, and I apologize that it wasn't emailed to you guys prior. Kind of a feeling for this region. And Mr. Steele, I have yours right here. It's just been folded up a whole bunch. First of all, I want to address the book cliffs. I spend a lot of time out on the book cliffs, and I know that this area is not in the central region, but I think it's important that we all realize that we can go all over the state and do go all over the state to enjoy the wildlife. So I hope that you'll pay attention and consider our recommended changes to it. We just feel that a 90% increase on the harvest objective for that unit is overkill. It does fit within the parameters of the plan. We just feel like that could be a real, you know, overkill of the lions, which would take them a long time to recover. Leslie touched on, and I think you asked a question about how fast it filled up. The book cliffs is really unique in the sense that in the middle of January, after it snows 2 feet, you can drive a two-wheel drive car out there because they plow all the roads for the oil and gas workers. One of the reasons that area fills up so quick and does fill up every year is the access. You can drive a two-wheel drive truck all winter long out there because every one of the roads is plowed. Therefore, you get a lot of outfitters and other people that will flock to that area because it's easier to get clients in closer to the tree, so to speak. And so that social aspect, when or if they've used it or the regional biologists have used it to determine to increase the tag, it's kind of unfair that fills up first. That's probably the easiest place in the state to hunt. You go up north, and if you don't have a snowmobile, you can't hunt. And so we ask, you know, yeah, it filled up quick, but consider the reason it filled up quick. It has really, really good access. The deer numbers, yes, they are below the target objective. We don't feel it's the lion's fault. We're not opposing an increase of the tags because the plan does call for it. We're just asking that they increase it to 25%. I spend 45 days on the book cliffs a year, and I think one of the main reasons that the deer numbers are down there is there's so much other wildlife out there. The division just increased, you know, wildlife numbers out there by putting a lot of buffalo out there, which is a good thing. But that's going to take away from some of the feed. And I know SFW and a lot of other interest groups have done chaining projects and stuff out there to help the deer feed. But the wild horse population's out of control out there. One spring I walked around with the state public school trust grounds guy showing them the springs because they were going to go try to rebuild all these springs that the wild horses had stomped down on. When the wild horses get in there and stomp down the springs, and springs don't come back up again, they go underground and disappear. And so there's different wildlife issues out there that are changing the book cliffs and are having an effect on the deer population.
Real quick on the Monroe, that from southern Utah, that's a real good source area for some of the other Lion units. Our members down in southern Utah asked us to ask that it go to limited entry. We're not objecting the increase in tags. We just like that to be a more quality hunt for some of the guys down in southern Utah and their region to give them that experience. I hope you'll consider these changes, and if you have any questions, I'll come back up to the mic or be happy to address them. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments from the public? If not, we'll bring it back to the rack for your deliberation.
I just wanted to give my thoughts briefly on the Houndsman's recommendations and thoughts. I mean, looking at the numbers, I mean, the Houndsman supported the plan that we just talked about in the previous item, and it seems like the sideboards that are set up, the increase on the book cliff seems reasonable considering the very high cougar numbers based on the parameters and the low deer numbers based on the parameters. And with the Monroe, the study makes complete sense. I get why you'd want to see it a different way, but, you know, with the study going on there, I think that's within the plan as well. And that's, I just wanted to address that from my standpoint.
Thanks. Any other comments? Ben.
First of all, I think I'd agree with Chris on both those statements with the book cliffs, especially on the book cliffs with the deer populations out there, and again the lower percent of female harvest on the cougars and the high percent of older class cougars. But what I would really like to discuss is, as I'm looking at this Nebo and Nebo West face, these are both in the predator management plan for both deer and sheep. And I struggle with the fact that we've taken them to limited entry and reduced the pressure there where they're both fall under that predator management plan for both deer and sheep, not just one. And so I would like to look at the possibilities of keeping that a split as opposed to a limited entry. I don't know if it's proper to...
You can put that in the form of a motion.
Okay, if we're ready for motion, I'll go ahead and do that. Specifically just to those two units, the Nebo and the Nebo West face, I'd move that we keep those as split units as opposed to limited entry.
Okay. I understand the motion. Give me a second. Go ahead.
So I think that's what you were getting at, Richard, earlier, and I kind of was left with the same question. So the quota last year was 19 for those two units. It's staying at 19. But I think what I was left wondering, kind of what you were getting at, was what impact in actual harvest is it going to have on those two units? I mean, we don't know what has been harvested. Say it's 15. Is it going to go down to 5 under a limited entry strategy?
So let me... I've got to... So Nebo, there were 9 permits, and total sport harvest was 7.
So the total harvest was 14 out of the 19.
Well, this is just for this.
I'm looking at the two combined.
Yeah, so it's a 56% success rate in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
2014 for the Nebo. It was at 16 and 13 were harvested. It was an 81 percent success, and actually she does have it broken down by permits and quota, and it was 81%. Success, and then in 2013 on Central Mountains Nebo, if I can find it, it was at 15, and a total of 9 were harvested for 60% success.
And I think you quoted it earlier that the limited entry success is right around 40.
43%.
43%.
Statewide. Statewide, and then it's about 68% for harvest objective.
So with 19, you expect maybe go down to 9 cats harvested between those two units, roughly speaking.
If you did straight, if you figured 48% success,
yeah. You leave roughly 5 cats on the mountain compared to by changing strategy.
And Chris, my thoughts there again are just that both those units are in the. Predator management plan for both deer and sheep, and with the split unit or the split season, you get that limited entry experience for a period of time, and then it's opened up, and I think that's appropriate for a unit that's under predator management plan.
Okay, we have a motion made by Ben. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay.
I have a question. Is it just the Nebo units we're voting on, or is it the entire rest of the plan? It's just Nebo.
I think it's just Nebo.
Yeah, my motion was specific to the Nebo, the Central Mountains Nebo, and the Central Mountains Nebo West Face.
Okay.
And that is, I'll second that, from a limited entry to a split unit, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Are we clear on that? Okay. Okay. Doing that, and then we'll call for a vote. All in favor? The vote is unanimous to take that to a split entry unit. So, okay. Okay, let's move on. Leslie, you're up again.
No, we
got
to.
No?
You're only about
to be. Okay, I got it. I'm sorry. Hold I'm on. Sorry. We get the vote, and I jump.
Do we have another motion?
We have another motion.
I have one more motion, if I know what I'm doing here. There's two things that concern me on this, and that's the Fillmore Pavant. We've lowered it down to 8, and I would like to see that go to 10 tags. And the other one is Mount Dutton. Since we're doing the goats there, they raised it to 14. Last night, I believe. Is that what you said, Leslie?
No. The region, after our meeting last night, when the region made the recommendations, they weren't considering the transplant on the recommendation for Mount Dutton. So after the RAC meeting last night, I spoke with the region today, and they agreed, because they were basing it on the 60% female. That's really high. And so we know we're impacting the population, so they agreed to maintain, because we are going above 40% on the female take. So it's under predator management at the current level that it's at, because we're taking 60% of them are females.
Okay. I'm still concerned about the Fillmore Oak Creek because of the deer that we've been putting in there, both, I believe, from Antelope Island and from down the southern part of the state. I'd like to see that go to at least 10 permits, from 8 to 10.
On the which one? Fillmore Pavant?
Fillmore Oak Creek.
Fillmore Oak Creek is under predator management at 12 for bighorn sheep. You mean the Pavant?
Oh, Pavant, yes. Pavant, Oak, yeah. All right, I'm a little Pavant. Fillmore Pavant. I'd like to see that go from 8 to 10.
Okay. Ken, you want to put that in the
I'd like to put that in a motion that we change change it to from 8 to 10.
Okay.
Can I just get a clarification on why you're asking for 2?
Because we've been spending a lot of money to put deer down there in that area on the translocations. And we're losing quite a few of them to cougars. And I just hate to see it drop when it's been 9, I think we ought to raise it to 10 instead of lower it.
Have you seen an effect on, even though you've put a lot of deer out there, have we seen an effect?
According to the studies, we're losing about 50% of the deer translocated, and most of those are to cougar.
Can I?
And that's from Utah State.
Yeah,
and they're the ones doing the study.
Clarify something on the Fillmore Pavant. Honestly, that could increase instead of decrease. It's at 39% female. I think they were just trying to keep it from going to 40%, and then they've got a high number that are above 5. So it could take an increase
if you're saying that it could fit under the plan to go to 10.
Yes.
And I would like to propose that it does go to 10.
And you backed off the Oak Creek.
Pavant, and we'll leave the Dutton at it's gone to 14. We'll leave the Dutton at 14.
Okay. So, clear on the motion. We need to restate it. Yeah, Larry.
The percent female is below 40%, and your age objective is supposed to be between 15 to 20, so it's at 30%, so you've got...
Yeah, we do on the...
Honestly, it's the region that made this recommendation. I don't think 10 would significantly hurt it, other than it may bump it into the 40% objective. But where they're doing the translocations, it would fit underneath the plan for translocation. Let me see what...
Fillmore.
I mean, it's possible if you add more, then it'll bump it into the 40%. I don't know what to tell. I mean, I don't think 10 is unreasonable, but.
Okay, Ken, you want to restate that motion?
What I would like to see, I make a motion that on the Fillmore Pavant, we change the number from 8 tags to 10 tags.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Alan, on the second? Okay. All in favor of the motion? Raise your hand. Opposed? Okay. The motion passes 10 to 1. Okay. Okay, we get a motion on the ballot.
I'll make the catch-all motion. I'll make the motion that we recommend the rest of the recommendations that have not been addressed currently. But with a reduction in the tags on the Bitter Creek from 38 to 8. Or not 38 to 8, 38 to 30.
Okay. Second, Ben. Okay. Question.
Yeah, I have a quick question. Is there any chance you could split that up, Carl?
Split.
Your motion.
Oh yeah, if you got another.
If you have another unit to address, let's just do Book Cliffs by separate.
I'm with you on some of it, but not all of it. That's the problem. So you want to address just the Book Cliffs.
Let's just do the Book Cliffs. I'll make the recommendation that the Boat Cliffs Bitter Creek goes from 38 tags to 30 tags for a 50% increase, not a 90% increase.
Okay. Ben, the second. Okay. All in favor of that motion? Four. All opposed? Okay. Motion is defeated. Okay. Any other motions?
I'll make a motion to accept the rest of the recommendations as presented.
Okay. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay. Ken? Okay. All in favor? Okay. That vote is unanimous. Okay. Now we can move on. Okay. Leslie with the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations.
All right. You're almost done with me. All right, so for bobcats, we have a bobcat management plan. It's set to expire in 2016, so we'll be reforming a committee to look at the bobcat management plan over the next year. The bobcat plan, the past 3 years, there was a cap on the number of tags that could be sold, and that cap was at 4,000. This past year, there are some variables that we look at with bobcat populations in order to decide where the cap, whether there should be a cap, how the number of tags that a person can have, and that type of thing. Last year, all of the variables were within the desired range except for one, and so the cap was removed off of the number of tags that could be sold, and it was set at six. We sold 13,475 tags, and 2,919 bobcats were harvested. Total trap harvest was 2,776, total incidental kill 78, and total non-trap harvest 143. So those were probably hounds or spot and stock. The number of trappers averaged 941, and the number of hunters pursuing bobcats averages 388. This past year, there were 1,105 trappers and 305 hunters afield for a total of 1,410. You can see that even though we sold a large number of tags, it was a significant increase in the number of tags that were sold. Harvest did not significantly increase. There are probably a lot of reasons for this, and most of it has to do with the fact that in order to pursue bobcats or harvest bobcats, it really helps to be knowledgeable about bobcats. And even though there were a lot more people that were afield, they were probably less experienced, and so they weren't as successful harvesting bobcats. So from our bobcat management plan that's been in place since 2007, there are performance targets that are used to adjust permit numbers and season dates. So the variables that we look at are the percent young in the harvest, and the target range that we like to see that at is about 42 to 56. The percent adult survival, we like to see that between 65 and 72. And the percent females, we like that to be between 41 and 45. Set days per bobcat is the only non-biological variable up here. And I'm going to say that one probably, it's one that's really hard to gauge bobcat populations by, because it really has more to do with the experience of the trapper or the hunter than it does really the bobcat population per se. The set days for Bobcat, according to the plan, are 177 to 220 days. So there are several years here, the past 4 years, including this last year. So you can see where we're at. The percent juvenile this past year was outside of our target range. It was at 60% of the harvest being made up of juveniles. So that's outside of the metric in a negative way. The percent survival was at 74, so that's outside of the metric, but it's in a good way. So the way that the plan's written, if those two kind of cancel each other out, so it's a net number of variables outside. Percent female is right about where we want it to be. It was at 45%. Set day per bobcat was at 373. That's way outside of the target range, but like I said, we had a lot of newcomers to the sport, or probably less experienced people, and so it took them probably a lot longer to harvest. So the way that it works, it has to be a net of two. And so the one positive one and the one negative one cancel each other out. So there's only one variable outside of the target range. So the plan dictates that we return to baseline for our recommendations. Baseline is that we allow six tags per individual and that the season run from the third Wednesday in November to the second Sunday in February, and that we do not cap the number of tags that are sold. This past year, the Trappers Association requested an extension on the week of the bobcat season. They actually requested 2 weeks added to the end of the bobcat season, and the Wildlife Board approved an additional week. We wanted to look at this to see if there was a difference in harvest between male and female. And you can see that as you get later on in the season, you harvest more males and fewer females, which is actually better for bobcat populations than to have equal numbers of sex in the harvest. So the later that we went, the fewer females that were harvested. So our current recommendations are for this year, 6 permits per individual, that the season, in accordance with the bobcat management plan, which dictates what days we can offer, November 18th to February 7th, which is the second in February. I can't remember. And no cap on the number of permits that are sold. other furberry season dates that we need to recommend at this time, beaver and mink, we're recommending that season go from September 26th to April 6th. Badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel from September 26th to the same ending as the bobcat season, February 7th. And marten, September 26th to February 7th as well. The next is a rule change recommendation, and this has to do primarily with the opportunity to trap on state waterfowl management areas. In the past, we've offered an opportunity to hunt or to trap on waterfowl management areas, but it was held as a drawing. And there were about 30 to 40 people that put in for that every year. The problem that we ran into with that is the drawing process really didn't give us the most experienced or knowledgeable person, and in some cases we got non-residents that weren't familiar with the area and couldn't come and trap as much as we needed them to. And again, this is a management opportunity. It's not a recreational opportunity. It's primarily to protect property damages from on the dikes from muskrats, to protect nesting waterfowl from predation from other predators like raccoons and skunks, and We're proposing a rule change to allow us to collect proposals from the public, and that we select the proposal with the greatest benefit to the division and our sportsmen. They have to possess trapping experience and a trapping license. They have to have familiarity with the WMA, and we are looking for somebody with an ability to focus on needed areas. So it'll be kind of a bid process. They'll be rated, and the best one will be selected. And that's what I have for you.
Thank you, Leslie. Any questions or clarifications from the RAC?
Just one on the last, where they would bid to come on. Is there an appeals process? Somebody that doesn't get picked is always going to be upset. Is there some way that they can say, look, you just picked your, you know, you always just pick your buddy? Is there an appeals process in that rule?
So what we're doing right now is we're working with the Attorney General, and it'll probably be set up similar to how we do coyote contracts. And they have to make an application, and then we sit down with the panel, and everybody will rate the answers to the application or their bid proposal, and you'll be given a scale. And then usually the one with the highest score would be the one that would be selected, and we have to document all of that. That's typically how we do those things. We're still working through some of that with the attorney, so...
Questions? Okay. Any other questions or clarifications from the public? Okay. I have one card on this. Kent Fowden?
Fowden, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the RAC, thank you for your time. I'm Kent Fowden. I represent the Utah Trappers Association. We support the recommendations by the Fish and Game as proposed, with one caveat, and I would ask this board to consider the week extension for one more year to go along. Next year, the management plan comes up for review, and the season lengths and things like that will be reviewed again at that time. However, for this year, I would request that you extend that one more week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kent, what's your reasoning for extending it?
We truly feel that it's like the people that like their big toms. We prefer to harvest bigger toms, more mature cats. We believe it'll take the pressure off to a point on the juveniles and things like that go later on in the season. The big toms start moving later. They're more accessible. So we believe there's a benefit to harvesting more toms.
I guess the question, did the dates you recommend, they voted to extend it, was that just a one-year extension? So do your dates,
do not include
that extra week?
No, our dates are included. So we're required to stay within our bobcat management plan, and it requires that we stop that first weekend in February. I do have one request, though, and that's if you consider the week-long extension, there was something that was overlooked the last year when the week-long extension was put on, and that's that badger, gray fox, kit fox, skunk, weasel, and marten all end February 7th. And what happened last year, we had a little bit of a law enforcement snafu because those all ended a week earlier. Bobcat went later, and we had incidental take in that time, and it made it illegal for them to harvest during that week. So if you entertain that motion, I'd ask that you include those species, except for beaver and mink, to end on the same day as badger or bobcat.
Okay. Ben.
Leslie, from your perspective, is there a reason not to recommend that extension for both bobcat and those other species you mentioned?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Ken?
I would like to make a motion then that we extend it. We accept what the division's proposed with the exception that we extend all those for one additional week.
Which species?
That would be everything that she had mentioned that she would like to have included.
Except for beaver and mink.
Except for beaver and mink, huh?
Okay.
I'll second that.
Okay, got a second? Okay. Any questions? Okay, let's take a vote. All in favor of the proposal? Okay, the vote is unanimous.
Thank you for your time, you guys.
Okay, that's four. No, it included everything. Everything with the exception. So I think we're good. We got that. Okay. Okay. Just quickly before we move into the next rule amendment, next section, I failed to recognize Calvin Crandall of the Wildlife Board here with us, and I'd like to recognize him. Okay. You're up. Jordan Nielsen.
Yeah, looks like Jordan.
Jordan decided he was going to send all his Candace regional biologists. Hutchinson. I am.
What's your name?
Candace Hutchinson.
Candace Hutchinson. Okay.
Right there. I'm Candace Hutchinson. I'm the Central Region AIS biologist. We have some rule modifications that we are requesting to rule R657-60. Yeah, Leslie just talks louder than I do. First of all, we need to change the definition of decontamination, change it to allow for alternate forms of decontamination via COR. Currently, this would require that CORs be issued to a business owner and that watercrafts damaged by I'll back up. We have found that there are instances where business owners want to comply with our decontamination procedures but are unable because of boats that are used too quickly turn around and are reused between trips, such as rafting. When the rule was first designated, these type of watercrafts were not considered. For example, rafting companies doing trips on the Colorado that do not fully comply, complete a dry time before the raft is on the water again, but also have the potential to of damaging their equipment with hot water decontamination. But they are willing to comply with the law, but are currently, but current definitions of decontamination make it impossible to comply. So the ability to issue a COR for a situation such as this would aid the division in increasing compliance from non-traditional boating businesses. We do that by a COR issued per business and determine appropriate measures to decontaminate those boats. Secondly, we need to change the boundaries of Lake Powell. In 2013, when Lake Powell was designated in the rule as infested, we needed to define a point of no return on each of its major tributaries to define the boundaries that boaters could use for upstream and downstream movement regarding their needs to decontaminate. We needed a point of no return. Spanish Bottoms was the set designation in the north. We need to change it out of the Colorado National Parks. Canyonlands National Parks into Glen Canyon National Park. So currently it's set at Spanish Bottoms, which is about 12 miles north of Glen Canyon National Park. We used the Colorado River, we used Spanish Bottoms as the last point that a jet boat could turn around and go back upstream before going to Cataract Canyon. And that represents a series of rapids that is generally not navigable in an upstream direction. Spanish Bottoms is located within Canyonlands National Park. The National Park would be required to create a management plan for a species they do not currently have right now. That's why we have the request. By designating a part of the Colorado River within the park as infested by quagga mussels, NPS is required to draft a management plan for quaggas. The species does not exist within the park. And in order to fix the problem, Canyonlands National Park, we need to move the official designation of Lake Powell downstream to Glen Canyon National Recreation Area boundaries. So it's set right there. It's an area that's familiar to rafters. It's also an area that is considered a point of no return. It's hard to get back upstream from that point as well. Also, we are asking for a modification to inspection of station rules. If you guys have seen our wire seals, that's what this one's concerning. So in 2014, Utah Division of Wildlife Resources received authorization to conduct non-law enforcement inspection stations to identify boats that had gone through inspection stations and we're completing a clean, drain, and dry process. We have started to put a tag on boats and give the owners a receipt for the inspection that needs to be presented at their time, at their next boating location to verify completion date. So there's a wire seal, and there's also a paper form to go with that. And I'll go into explanation on that a little bit more. There are only two places where tags are applied, so Deer Creek Reservoir and Lake Powell. And mainly those two places are for orange tags. Orange tags will indicate that the boat is dirty. We also do a clean tag for blue. And if the boat gets professionally decontaminated by one of our technicians, then we issue a blue. But the orange tags are only being issued currently at Deer Creek and Lake Powell. This rule change makes it unlawful for a boater to destroy a tag or receipt before verifying that decontamination has been completed by dry time or by hot water. The tag also allows for transportation to storage areas and complete dry time. Right now it's illegal to transport a mussel within the state. This tag says that you've started that process and that you can move it to somewhere to complete that drying time. But the boater must retain the receipt and not destroy the seal. So if you've seen it, you're attaching the boat to the hull of the boat and to the trailer, or the tag to the hull of the boat and the trailer. Colorado uses a couple different colors. We only use orange for dirty boats, so it hasn't completed the dry time, has not been professionally decontaminated, and it's come off Lake Powell or Deer Creek. Deer Creek is our suspect water, where we had one positive sample, and Lake Powell is where we are currently finding adult quagga mussels within the state. And then we also use a blue tag to indicate that it has been professionally decontaminated. If you look at our cert form, we have an orange spot right there. It kind of looks a little red with protractor. And that's to indicate that they have started the dry time. We indicate what has been inspected when they came off the water. And we put a date and an authorized signature right there to indicate how long when they started that drying process. And again, at the bottom, we have a blue portion where we put our seal number for the seal, and then we also put the seal number orange, and then a signature. We also have a spot in the corner where we actually put an official stamp, which will indicate what water body the boat came off of or where it got decontaminated. We have stamps for our port of entries, for Deer Creek, and for Lake Powell currently right now. We'll probably be getting some stamps for some other water bodies like Utah Lake, Jornell tend to decontaminate a lot of boats coming off Deer Creek that want to launch before by helping Deer Creek alleviate some of the pressure. It's another point that they can go. So when they head to those parks, they have an orange tag, and then the state parks will decontaminate them and give them a blue tag, and then they can go where they'd like to go, if that's out of state or back down south. And that's all I have for you.
It's quite the process now.
It is. I mean,
it's just so complicated.
You got a tiger by the tail. So
wow. Okay, thank you, Candace. Any questions, clarifications by the rack? Ken.
Quick question. If you go to Deer Creek, you do not need to decontaminate your boat if you're going right back to Deer Creek. Am I correct?
You do not, but they will issue an orange tag with that, and they'll want to check and make sure that you did not go into Lake Powell. So you will still need to have that tag attached to the boat and verified before you launch.
But if you go to Lake Powell and then come to Deer Creek, do you need to decontaminate your boat before you put it on the water?
Yes.
Okay.
Deer Creek is currently suspect. We've not been able to find adult mussels in the water body, and we've only had one sample come back positive. We've had four other samples since then. We've had April, May, June, and July come back. I think we had July come back negative. If not, we're still waiting on that sample. So because we cannot identify adult mussels, it's just suspect. So we're trying to keep out all boats that have been in a positive water or an infested water out of there.
I have a question. You mentioned something about the river rafters that go down, and you wanted to be able to issue a core to them. For how would they decontaminate their boats? I mean, what's the process for them?
Right now, since heat would ruin many of their rafts and the dry times not appropriate for where their business is, there's a couple options of a diluted solution of chlorine or bleach. Quat can also be used, applied within the correct proportions, and there's a couple other scientifically based processes out there, usually chemically based, that might be found appropriate for what their process is.
Okay, thank you. Throw it out to the public. Anyone like to, any questions or clarifications? I don't have any cards on this. Any comments from the public? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the rack for their deliberation.
I'll make a motion to adopt the changes as presented.
Okay, seconded by Ken. Okay, all in favor? Okay, vote is unanimous. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, you guys.
Okay, youth fishing exemption rule amendments. Who have we got?
Rick Olson. You guys were an easy audience.
Rick Olson, huh? Okay.
My name's Rick Olson. I'm with the law enforcement section with the division. And I've got three... Yeah. Three pretty quick amendments to rules that we need to run past the board, the RAC and the board. The first one is an amendment to Rule 657-45, which is the license exemption for youth organizations or school activities. Okay, Utah State Code creates a program where certain organizations, such as Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, or nonprofit group, where individuals, kids, if they're under 16 years old, can fish for free. Part of that code section requires the Wildlife Board pass a rule specifying what type of documentation is needed for those groups. This proposal will satisfy that subsection of the rule. The proposal that we are proposing will be done totally online. Well, let me back up just a sec. This has been a code. We've had this program for several years, but there was never a rule to back up the process that we had. And that process was a form online, but it was just a PDF that anybody could go print out, fill out, and then that was their documentation they had in the field if they were checked by an officer. This new proposal will still be done online, but the division will be able to track it, so we know how many people are participating in this program. And when they fill it out, they'll fill out a portion that will get submitted to the division. They'll still print the paper documentation, but the division will be able to track how many people participate, and we've never had that before. But they will have to provide the name of the organization or the group, the date and location where they're going to go fishing, the approximate number of youth that they're going to have, and the officers are not going to go there. You've got a paper for five kids and you got six. It's just approximate. And the name and the contact information from the group leader. In the past, we've required the names of the kids. We're not going to require that anymore, just the name of the leader. Now, the leader, the requirements on him or her, they must be 18 years of old or older. They have to possess a valid fishing or combination license. They must provide instruction to the youth, and they must have approval from the school or the organization they're just representing. So in summary, this is just an ongoing program we've always had. It's just getting a rule in place to back it up. And volunteers get a chance to work with the youth, and the youth get a chance to get involved with fishing. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Rick. Any questions or yes?
A quick question. How is a group, you had put down that they must be a nonprofit, but what classifies a group or an organization as being eligible for this?
That should be in your packet if you got all the data, but it's basically a 501(c) group.
Okay.
Any other questions? Anything from the public? Okay, any comments from the public? Okay. Bring it back to the rack for your determination. Yes.
I'll motion to accept the amendments to Rule 65745 as presented.
Okay. Got a second? Okay. Okay, we have a second. All in favor? Okay, the vote is unanimous. Okay, thank you, Rick. Okay, self-defense against animals rule amendment. I read this, pretty interesting. Go ahead, Rick.
Okay, this proposal amends Rule 657-63, which is self-defense against wild animals, which basically is the rule that says if an animal does this, you can shoot it in self-defense. Okay, so the problem that we had with the current rule is that most of the other self-defense laws in Utah that are in the criminal code does not require the person to retreat. So if somebody were to come after you to hurt you, you don't have to run away. The way our current rule reads, our rule, it references the individual has a responsibility to safely retreat if possible. Okay, the way the rule reads now, and this would not change, but a person is justified in using force when that person has a reasonable belief that force is necessary to protect themselves or others from an imminent attack. And then there's a series of factors to help us determine what is reasonable. One of those factors was the ability to safely retreat. We'd like to change that to the ability to safely avoid the danger. The second amendment would add verbiage into the rule that indicates life and safety of a human is paramount to life and safety of a wild animal. And the third one, a person will have presumed to have acted reasonable if the wild animal enters a home, tent, camper, or similar living structure occupied by the person, provided the wild animal is capable of causing severe bodily injury or death. So if a pika jumps into your tent, you can't blast him. Okay? The animal has to be capable of causing some damage to you. And the wild animal is killed while attempting to enter, or is occupying the structure. So if you got to your cabin and you seen a bear climb out the window and run away, you can't go on a bear hunt. But if the bear's, like in the picture, sitting on your table when you walk through, you could take that animal and be covered under this rule. So in summary, the reasonableness of the rule will be based on the ability to safely avoid, not retreat. We add life and safety of humans is paramount, and the wild animal is in a living structure and reasonably perceived to cause severe injury or death, could be killed. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the rack? Chris?
I had one question. So in one part of the rule, it includes domestic animals, right? So something, if I read that right, somewhere it says something along the lines of...
Oh, if they're attacking a domestic animal?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so in another section, in 4B, it says, notwithstanding a person lawfully pursuing a cougar or bear with dogs may kill that cougar or bear when they reasonably believe that such action is necessary to protect themselves or another person. Is that inclusive of their dogs?
Yes. Yeah, it would be. We had a case, the Central Region is really our test region for case on self-defense of moose. And we've had a couple in this region this last year. And one of them, a moose did stomp the dog, and the owner shot the moose, ended up killing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the county attorney ruled that he had that right based on our rule to do that.
Okay. I just thought it was interesting. This was specifically called out, but no mention of the dogs in there. So I'm wondering if we shouldn't clean that up a little bit just to make it clear.
Yeah, those attorneys write these things for us, and they're not always that smart.
Okay. I've got a question. The term avoid, the word, that could be you shouldn't have been there in the first place. I'd like for you to address that a little bit and explain, because that's pretty broad.
It is, and laws are written in black and white, and enforcement's done in shades of gray. So our officers use a lot of discretion in how they enforce some of these laws. Some of this verbiage came because of certain legislators that wanted us to write a rule that said you didn't have to move at all, that you could just stand your ground and say, come get me, I'm going to shoot you. And so the word avoid was a compromise with these legislators.
I've got a quick comment on that. I would assume that you can't legislate stupid. So people that come onto animals, like you had a picture on the background where they were all standing around a moose. And I wonder how many cases you've had where people have stopped and got too close to animals. Animals feel intimidated and come after them. And then if they think they're threatened and kill that animal at that point, I mean, I would think that aren't they part of that problem in the first place?
They kind of are, but we don't have very many cases across the state every year where this occurs.
You just get the selfies in Yellowstone.
Yeah, a lot of that.
Yeah.
I went through Yellowstone last year. I saw a lot of that. So.
Yeah, I just was there this spring.
That lady went way up in the air.
Some of them deserve to be gored.
That's my point. So,
I just would hope that they wouldn't be covered under self-defense laws if one stupidity plays a factor in that at the same time.
Yeah, that's why the avoid's there at least. So if somebody was... let's see, where'd my picture go? This picture there.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
They can walk off the trail. If they just keep walking toward that moose and he goes after them, that's going to be up to a county attorney whether that one is going to get prosecuted.
Because they should have backed up.
Because they could have backed up or gone around or done something to avoid it.
Avoided it or backed up, avoided it.
Right.
Any other questions? Anything from the public? Any comments? Okay. Bring it back to the rack for your deliberation. Chris?
Yeah, I just... Because that specific instance is in there, I just think we ought to add something about the dogs, you know, for the cougar and bear hunters. I don't know if... You feel like we can just leave it that, make a motion in that simple, or we should propose specific language around that, as far as making a motion to add that language.
Yeah, I've kind of thought of that too as you brought that up. Is if they're out in a with a pursuit permit, let's say, and I assume they're legally able to carry a weapon with them, mm-hmm. even in with pursuit permit. If a cougar or a bear turns on their dogs, can they kill that animal?
So that's what he said, harm yes. Them. Yeah, and that's...
And not,
mm-hmm. If they're hunting already, they have...
Yeah, but if it's just a pursuit permit...
Yeah.
Okay.
It can be just can a pursuit where they're not legally taking, but they're just training dogs.
Are they asking for that? I mean, they're pursuing an animal.
Well, that's why I'm asking for consistency, because in one part of the rule, it says you can protect domestic animals. And that's part of the self-defense. It's not specific.
Pursuit, like you're actively pursuing the animal, so you're sort of. It may happen, right? If you're pursuing an animal,
it could.
Murdering them, you're kind of taking that risk. If you're out recreating with your dog or another pet, you're not really pursuing, so you're...
Right. Well, I don't know that I would agree if you're out with pursuit, that if a cougar starts knocking your dogs off a cliff, you should just watch them all go over the cliff either. I don't know that I would agree with that. You should be able to stop that cougar, and, you know, it's an unfortunate situation, but I think you ought to be able to...
In a reasonable
sure.
circumstance.
Right.
Knowing that something
well,
this
was
about to happen.
One way to handle it is to just recommend that the attorney
review
that
right.
If it's vague like that.
Well, and that makes sense. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Rick. I mean, you had mentioned that.
The way I read this, again, if you read it, I don't think they could kill that cougar or bear. If it's not a threat to them and only their dog.
I think under Section 1 they could. Under the other, it sounds like they couldn't.
Right. That's the problem. Is it seems like it's inconsistent to me.
I see your point.
So it would need to be
right.
It would need to
clarify. Right.
So Chris, you're talking Section 1 is the
right.
one that talks about the domestic and...
Right.
And then were you under Section 5 when you wanted to listen?
It's Section 4B.
Yeah.
Where it just talks about...
Pursuing a cougar.
Yeah, it just talks about people, essentially. It doesn't include... It just seems unclear. And maybe the just have the lawyers look at it and readdress that might be the right motion. I don't know, but... But they're engaged in illegal activity, though, too. They're not engaging in exceptional danger or, you know, they're doing something completely illegal, like walking down a trail and you happen to run into a moose. I mean, pursuit is just as legal.
The
Out of curiosity, Rick, have you ever come across that situation?
No,
somebody
because
with a pursuit permit because ended if, up having to kill a cougar because it was going to kill
I wish
dog.
We still had the houndsman guy here. Most of the houndsmen would probably tell you that if their dog let that lion come out and kill them, they deserve to die. It's not a very good
thing. Well, and that's fair enough. And the only reason I even thought of it was, you know, we don't have wolves currently in Utah, but I know a couple of houndsmen up Montana and that have lost a lot of dogs to wolves, and to the point they've quit being houndsmen. And that's the only reason I thought of that when I read this section and wondered if it was appropriate to add it, and I just wanted to bring it up for discussion.
What would you propose?
Well, if I would just simply add, you know, pursuing may seriously injure or kill. Just going on here. Such action is necessary to protect themselves or another person or their dogs.
I think when they wrote this, the intent of the first one was a domestic dog that's not a hound chasing it.
Sure.
It's your foo-foo dog that's with you while you're hiking.
Well, and that's why I asked initially if a hound's, you know, felt like his dogs were in danger, would it be legal, based on your understanding, to do that? And you had said yes, and that's why I said if that's the case, then we should add it.
It's one definition in the code.
Right.
Ultimately, these are always determined by a county attorney.
Mm-hmm.
In my career, I've had quite a few self-defense cases,
mm-hmm.
but never one like that.
Okay, and maybe we're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist.
Yeah,
so,
houndsmen lose their dogs every now and then. That's kind of
this part of the deal.
Right.
Part of the deal.
I was going to say, isn't that the liability of running a dog? Is that you're going to eventually lose a dog, or you know, one may
well,
get attacked?
I think there's a difference between, you know, one dog gets hurt and that's it. You're not there. Cat's knocking your dogs off cliffs, and you know there's six of them there, and they're going one by one, and you can stop it. And then those stories exist. That's a real scenario.
Yeah, I understand that, but I think he's right. It's going to be a county attorney if you're walking your lab and a bear comes out and starts mauling your dog, and you shot that bear. It's going to be a lot easier to that county attorney to look the other way than it is if you're running and pursuit dogs. I think, and one gets killed, and then you kill it. I think it's going to be a tough circumstance that. The be in, and that county attorney is going to be making that decision whether it was justified or not. And I think to try to legislate that or write a law against that, you're going to have people take advantage of that and shoot animals just because they say they thought their dog was at risk. So yeah. I think that could be it.
They're going to get a ticket if they've got a pursuit permit and killed a cougar, and then it's going to go to the
most likely
attorney.
Yeah, they're going to have to really justify somehow how their life was in danger.
Yeah,
right. And that's why I go back to the original. If that's not the case, then I think it's fine the way it is. My original question: if that's not the case, then I think the language is the way it's fine the way it is. If you're telling me from a law enforcement perspective, or the idea or the concept behind was that if that scenario were to happen and you wouldn't write a ticket, then I think it should be in there. So it's all dependent upon that basic question to me. If you're saying that's a liability that. Did the houndsman take them, then I think the language is fine.
That's how I'd initially look at it, and they'd have to convince us, I guess, if it was something different.
Okay, well, in that case, then I think the language is fine.
Hello? I'm still a little confused between this retreat and avoid. I think retreat is more specific. Avoid is pretty broad. What benefit would we have to change it from retreat to avoid?
It is. You're exactly right. Avoid is more broad. And that was the point that was brought up by certain people, that retreat means if you get out of your car and you start walking up the trail and you see this moose, you got to go back to your car and get out of there. And they said, you shouldn't have to do that. If you go out of your way to avoid it, and then it still comes after you, you've met that requirement, and you could kill it if it was attacking you at that point.
But in this amendment, you can also stand your ground, right? As opposed to having being required to retreat.
Right.
can?
Excuse me?
You can stand your ground?
Yeah, to a degree, with reasonableness.
I mean, it wasn't,
you know, found.
So,
like I said, if you were there on that trail there, and you said, I'm going to stand my ground, I'm just going to go bump that moose out of the way. Well, the moose probably isn't going to let you do that. He's probably going to go after you, and if you shot it, we'd probably be taking it to the county attorney saying, you did nothing to try to avoid this at all.
Well, I think by stand your ground, I think you just mean
something's charging you.
Yeah, if something's charging you, you're not required to run away.
No, you're not.
To me, it kind of comes down to, if a bear approaches you, you can shoot it in self-defense without having to retreat. But if you sneak up on a bear and poke it with a stick, you probably can't claim self-defense.
You're crawling in the den. It might be a problem.
Yeah. Jose, you can't kill those bears.
Yeah, I was looking for our bear dinner.
Our bear dinner.
But they're usually a little groggy in the den when our guys do it.
They're still in La La Land.
Okay. Any more discussion? Okay. Open for a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve as presented.
Okay. Larry, second. All in favor? Okay. Vote is unanimous. Okay.
Can I make one more comment real quick? I realize we've already voted, but I just want to mention I'm glad that we've put the clause in there that basically says a human life's worth more than an animal. I think that's a great addition. So thank you.
Okay.
Okay, the last one I have is an amendment to the Upland Game and the Waterfowl Rule. And you guys probably just visited the waterfowl one a month ago or so.
Yeah.
But they missed a part. Okay, the purpose of this proposal is to bring our rule in line with state firearms laws. We fully recognize and support an individual's right to possess firearms. This picture looks like opening day at Farmington Bay Duck Marsh. Perfectly legal. If this passes. Okay, the current version of these rules have provisions that limit the mere possession of the firearm. Okay, we are proposing to change that to you can possess whatever kind of firearm you want because state law gives you that right, but you can only discharge it when we say you can. And one important part here, this only applies to the WMAs that are specifically listed in either the Upland Game Guidebook or the Waterfowl Guidebook. This doesn't apply to most of the mountain WMAs that we have. And what the proposal is to restrict the discharge only to legal weapons during open season for lawful hunting purposes or as authorized by a COR or other permit or for lawful purposes of self-defense. So, in summary, we propose the changes to these rules to ensure they're consistent with firearms laws in the state. We would restrict the discharge of the firearm on certain WMAs to those three requirements. It has to be a legal weapon during an open season for lawful hunting purposes or for self-defense or if you have a COR.
So that duck was charging you. Was that an example of
right.
Self-defense?
So what firearms laws are really complicated. They get more complicated every year. And what a lot of people don't know or don't realize, I guess, a guy could come walking right through that door right now with a deer rifle slung over his shoulder. He's perfectly legal. Now, you guys are all probably going to, like, really get a little nervous. My hand's going to get closer to my gun if I've seen that. But if he can walk in here with a rifle, he probably ought to be able to walk onto our WMAs with a rifle. Now, they can't shoot a duck or a pheasant with that rifle because that's not a legal weapon for that species.
Yeah.
And the concealed weapon, I mean, all that, anybody can open carry.
Right.
But if somebody wanted to carry a pistol that was concealed on our WMAs, they'd still have to have a concealed carry permit for that.
Place with an open weapon.
Seen it once.
It's a little strange. Well,
he kind of keep an
eye
on
it. Sounds like it's in response to just being able to have something with you.
It is. It's in response from the
acceptance of defense.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
Quick question. So, let me understand this. So, if a person was down there and he started to see foxes or something like that on a wildlife management area, could he discharge a rifle to shoot those?
Probably. That's our issue. But the attorneys couldn't find a way to write it to preclude that. Not necessarily foxes, a coyote. Or a raccoon is a better example because they're not protected wildlife. We have no control over how those are taken. But yes, probably. We don't want to advertise that because really it comes down to it is not safe to discharge rifles on some of these areas with hunters out in the field. So there is that little loophole there that we hope a lot of people don't take advantage of it. I mean, in my career, I've caught two guys that had rifles out on a duck marsh, but they were actually hunting geese with them.
Wow.
And other hunters called them in because bullets were whizzing over their heads, and they weren't trying to be secret about it. They were a different nationality that wasn't familiar with our laws. They were wearing bright orange big game vest with little bullet loops to hold their bullets. And they were pretty shocked when I said, "You can't hunt geese with these." And they're like, "Why not? They're really good."
They shoot a long ways.
But so I don't think this is going to... I don't think we're going to have an onslaught of people out there hunting pheasants or ducks with a shotgun in one hand and an AR-15 in another. More likely, a guy's going to have a pistol for self-defense. It just lets him be legal. Where right now, the way the rule's written on these WMAs, for waterfowl, the only weapon you could possess is a shotgun, unless you had a concealed carry permit.
Okay. Any other questions? Any public questions?
I guess, wouldn't that be favorable in the sense if someone has a pistol and they see a fox or a coyote and the opportunity presents itself to shoot it, wouldn't that benefit the WA in that way? In the sense of you're given an opportunity that, you know, if they're going through the brush and they stumble upon one and they can possess, then I would see that as a benefit.
Yeah, we're not concerned about the take of these other species like a fox or a coyote. We're concerned about the safety.
Well, what I'm saying is it would give the ability in the sense that he could discharge that firearm on that species and he'd have a pistol in hand in the sense that he had it.
Right.
He could multiple use it, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
It would be legal to do that right now if this passes.
I thought you said you couldn't discharge.
Well, because a coyote, there's no season. You can shoot them with anything, anytime.
Yeah, I know, but I thought you couldn't discharge any other weapon. You could carry a weapon, but you couldn't
You could discharge it.
Yeah, I don't know that you could.
Yeah.
For an open season for lawful hunting. Coyotes are open all year long. It's lawful to shoot them. And there's no restriction on what kind of a weapon you can shoot them with. Foxes are a little bit grayer because they are considered protected wildlife, but we have a provision in the rule they can be taken year-round as long as the pelt's not sold. I mean, if you're trapping foxes to sell the pelt, you have to have a license. But if you're out pheasant hunting and see a fox run away, you can legally shoot that as long as you don't sell the hide.
Okay.
without any kind of license.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, bring it back to the rack. Chris?
Make an amendment to
motion?
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion to accept the amendments to Rule 657-6.
And 9.
And 9, yes.
Okay. Second. Ben, the second. Okay, all in favor? Okay, vote is unanimous. Thank you. Here we go.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, fee schedule.
There are no fee increases.
Okay.
All those in favor? Anything.
Last night, at least, they had a PowerPoint and one slide that said there are no fee proposals.
Well, see, we didn't even need that. Take my word for it. There are none.
I thought they were going to have a fee. Well, the legislature has to do that for the multi-season.
We're
going to
have some this next year, but we decided not to run any this year.
Okay. Okay. Just do this 5-day Falcon.
You know, I think you probably do.
Okay. Does somebody want to make a motion on that?
Motion to
our designated motion maker.
He's good.
I'll second that motion.
Okay.
Was it because the presentation was so good?
It was incredibly quick.
Clear, concise, and
all in favor? Okay. Vote is unanimous. Okay. Okay. 5-day falconry meet request. Okay. Come forward.
Take
your pick. That's a real nice podium, by the way.
Do you want me to reread the letter that I sent to you guys, or just kind of paraphrase what this is about?
Paraphrase it.
All right. So, the International Austrian Association is basically the IEA. It's a group of falconers that hunt with golden eagles. We are proposing to do a meet this fall in October in Utah County where we would take non-protected and protected species with golden eagles, as well as there would be some of accipiters being in there as well. So you'd have goshawks and some budios, which would all be licensed through licensed falconers. In the rule right now, it states that for us to do this meet to where non-residents can have a 5-day basically meet license to hunt protected species, I have to come before you guys and the board for that. So that's why I'm here. And we're proposing it in October 22nd through the 23rd, or the 20th through the 23rd. And we will be generally hunting west of Lehigh and then some part of the Wasatch Front, just mountain ranges, mainly pursuing either at that point grouse or cottontail, and then in the Lehigh area we'll pursue jackrabbits as well as potential fox. So
okay.
Most of it will be public land. There's some potential property I'm looking at that's right in Saratoga Springs. I don't know who it is, but it's basically a development that we've hunted there before. There's no trespassing. And I was considering getting permission there because right now it's landlocked, so you can't fire a gun, whereas falconry, that wouldn't be an issue, and there is a lot of jackrabbits in that area. Other than that, most of the area would be public land that we're going to hunt. Or there's some potential private land in Alpine that I have access to that we would hunt. So,
how much area do you need?
It just varies in the sense of we're going to have 20 to 30 participants, maybe a little more, and then they're going to go out in groups and hunt those geographical areas. And so it's just going to depend on, with jackrabbits, 3 acres. I mean, it just depends on kind of your density of game. When it comes to hunting grouse on the side or anything, I mean, really, you just start walking and kind of go from there. I don't know if you guys are all familiar with the sport of falconry. Yes or no? Is there any clarification I need to make on that? So.
No, I was just going to ask you if you knew that was the second weekend of the deer hunt. It's also popular, right?
And yeah. Before you answer that, let me add to that question. The dates that you had mentioned are different than the ones in your letter.
Sorry. Did I? It's the 23rd.
Your letter says the 23rd to the 25th.
Sorry. That's,
is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. It's like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
So are you gonna? Is there going to be a place on the Wasatch Mountains you're going to want to hunt? Did you say that?
When I say the Wasatch, I mean PG. I mean, I'm very familiar with the PG Wasatch front, just above the houses that we do hunt for cottontails and stuff like that, which I don't think we're going to have that many deer hunters right there because we hunt, 100 yards to 200 yards above the houses. And with falconry, that never creates a conflict.
Not an issue with fawns?
With fawns?
Fawns and golden eagles?
That shouldn't be an issue. And generally, we'll hunt the eagles out on the open range more in Lehigh area. So I don't see that being a big issue. And when it comes to eagles, we're probably going to have 3 to 4 eagles. It's not like we're going to bring 30 eagles into the state.
Well, that's a pretty decent size out here.
Yeah, they are by then.
So if you do hunt public grounds,
correct. And that's what this approved is basically they approve a permit for non-residents to come in to hunt protected species, which would include pheasants and the potential of fox. And fox gets a little gray because the red fox is not protected versus or we could hunt it year-round versus the kit fox is. There's also the stipulation within the falconry rule that if we're pursuing a red fox and a kit fox runs out and that eagle does take that fox, we can eat off of that fox, and then we just leave the remains of that fox there, and that's called the leave it lie law. Basically, because after that bird is, in theory, released, I can't dictate, and that's the same reason why we can hunt male or female pheasants in that regard. Or that's kind of the whole. There's a natural gray area when it comes to falconry when we're pursuing game that way. So.
Do people pay to be in the event?
No. It's just a public opportunity for eagle falconers and falconers alike just to get together and have it.
What's your moral take as far as how many animals
worth one? I would say your take is probably 30 to 40%, depending on it's not it's.
Per day.
Do
they get plenty of it? One animal per day. Or?
Yeah, I would say 1 to 2 of hunting. 4 to 5 hours. So it's not.
One day.
So, I mean, the potential you're probably looking at this is, the potential of maybe 15 to 20 rabbits maybe per day. I'd say even close to 7 maybe. And when it comes to fox, 25%. I mean, because the conditions in that way have to be pretty favorable to them. So. It will not be a meat, from my thoughts, it will not be a meat where you will harvest a ton of game, like if you were a gun hunter or something like that. So.
Hey, Carter, I would just to follow up on what Sarah said, with an organized event, I would encourage you to check with the, if you're going on to BLM west of Lehigh, you may want to check with the Salt Lake office. They may have a permit that you have to get, so. You have to check with them. So
okay, we do a meet every year in February that I know is on BLM land and to this, and I'll do that. But I to this day we have not had to get a permit for that, and that's been going on for a decade. Is that a? Yes. I apologize. I'll make a point to. I'll make a point to let that president know on that. Say again. And do we need a permit for that? For a meet?
For an event. Any event. Public land. Profit or not.
Okay.
So we know you're there.
Okay. Could I get your information for how I obtain that permit? Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Public.
Well, one more question. Now, you had mentioned pheasants. What's educate me a little bit. What's the season on pheasants for falconry?
Pheasants. It's either September 1 or September 30th. Our season runs longer than the traditional gun hunter season. So I think it starts September 1 and goes to February or March. I don't have the exact dates in front of me. But we would be in that legal parameter of what the falconry has already been approved for.
So you're talking to us so that an out-of-state bird can be brought in? Right?
Not brought in, that there's an allowance so that the five-day permit can be given to that person coming into the state.
Five-day hunting permit.
Correct.
And then, do they buy that? They give it to them? Or?
They buy it. So.
So that's the question. Not whether they can have the event or not.
And this is open to the public. Any public can come watch.
Yeah.
It's actually, I've watched it about the guys. It's actually pretty.
One thing I'd like to say.
Yeah, it's a cool thing in that sense.
Yes, I've watched the falconry guys out there in Fairfield area a few years ago with the falcons, and they do pigeons, and it is quite a sight and very interesting.
And I mean, you guys are more than welcome also to come out if you ever want to come to these meets.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
I think, isn't the question or the motion that we need to make is that five-day COR for non-residents. Okay.
So what's the difference between this five-day non-resident meat license as opposed to them just buying a non-resident hunting license?
I don't know. I mean, I just know that for us to have a meet and to have a non-resident purchase that, we have
it's
to
required
for you. So, I don't.
Okay.
And he's asking us to approve that.
Sure. Yeah.
That five-day COR.
I'll make the motion to approve that. I'll make the motion to approve that.
Okay. Got a second? Larry, a second? All in favor? Okay. It's unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Get
what
it.
I'd like to know is how the heck do they get a permit to get a golden eagle? That's got to be kind of hard.
It's
hard.
That's done through official wildlife service. I think you got a meeting is adjourned.
Okay, meeting is adjourned.